Good evening. I'm Amna Nawaz. Jeff Bennett is away. On the NewsHour tonight, Israelis celebrate Passover as tens of thousands remain displaced and the war with Hamas rages on. As college protests against Israel's war in Gaza spread, a look at how they compare to demonstrations of the past. And a new investigation reveals how some of the seafood that ends up on our plates is produced by the forced labor of North Koreans.
The globalized world we live in, and the way that seafood in particular largely routes through China, means that many, if not most, brands in the U.S. are tainted by this.
Welcome to the NewsHour. Egypt has sent a high-level delegation to Israel tonight, hoping to revive talks for a hostage deal and ceasefire with Hamas. But Cairo also warned against an Israeli assault on the southern Gaza city of Rafah, along the border with Egypt. Much of Gaza has already been reduced to a wasteland, with UN officials estimating 37 million tons of debris to be removed. They said today that the cleanup operation will be a mammoth job.
With 100 trucks, we're talking about 14 years of work with 100 trucks. So that's based on that figure, 14 years to remove with approximately 750,000 workdays, person workdays to remove the debris. So significant numbers when it comes to debris.
The UN said roughly 65% of the buildings destroyed in Gaza have been residential ones. The U.S. military today announced a new weapons package to rearm Ukraine's air defenses. It includes more Patriot missiles, but not the additional Patriot batteries that Ukraine had wanted. Still, in Washington, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said he believes this package, along with other weapons, will meet Ukraine's needs.
They need other types of systems and interceptors as well. And so I would caution us all in terms of making Patriot the silver bullet. I would say that it's gonna be the integrated air and missile defense, as we said so many times before, that really turns a tide.
The new weapons package will cost some $6 billion. It's part of $61 billion in military aid that Congress approved after months of deadlock. Meanwhile, another member of the Biden cabinet, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, warned Chinese President Xi Jinping today against supporting Russia's war in Ukraine. The two men met in Beijing. Blinken said he told Xi that China must stop supplying Russia with critical war materiel or the U.S. will act. He did not elaborate, but he did acknowledge progress in other areas.
We are committed to maintaining and strengthening the lines of communication between us so that we avoid any miscommunications, any misperceptions, any miscalculations. And we are committed to responsibly managing the relationship.
For his part, Xi said China and the U.S. must seek common ground rather than engage in what he called, quote, vicious competition. Britain's King Charles will return to public duties next week after a three-month break for cancer treatment. Buckingham Palace said today that doctors are very encouraged by his progress so far. The palace has not yet said what kind of cancer the king has. Here at home, the Biden administration has again delayed a ban on menthol cigarettes. Javier Becerra, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, announced that today, saying, quote, it's clear that there are still more conversations to have, and that will take significantly more time. The ban could have angered black voters, since 80% of black smokers use menthol cigarettes. U.S. poultry producers will have to cut salmonella bacteria in some chicken products to very low levels to prevent food poisoning. A final Agriculture Department regulation issued today applies to frozen, breaded, and stuffed raw chicken. It takes effect next year. Salmonella poisoning causes roughly 420 deaths and 1.3 million infections annually in the U.S. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is investigating whether last year's Tesla recall went far enough. The software update aimed to keep drivers alert while using the autopilot feature, but there have been more crashes since then. Today, the agency said the autopilot feature, quote, may lead drivers to believe that the automation has greater capabilities than it does. And on Wall Street, strong earnings at Microsoft and Alphabet pushed the stock market higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 153 points to close at 38,239. The Nasdaq rose 316 points. The S&P 500 added 51. Still to come on the NewsHour, the connection between forced North Korean labor and some of the seafood that ends up on American plates. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart weigh in on the week's political headlines. Musician Jon Bon Jovi on the new docuseries capturing the highs and the lows of his Grammy Award-winning band's four decades together.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
This week, Jews around the world are observing Passover, the festival of liberation that marks the historic exodus from ancient Egypt. But this year, joy is tempered with loss and trauma. More than 160,000 Israelis will mark the holiday while displaced from their homes as the war with Hamas continues. Still others have empty chairs at the dinner table, their loved ones still held captive by Hamas. Ali Rogan has more.
In the rugged hills of northern Israel, Metula's mayor patrols his town where now no one lives.
See, this is Lebanon.
Lebanon is so close that this border town of 2000 had to be evacuated under government orders. David Azouli moves around in a golf cart. He says it's faster to escape when the rockets crash.
This is the synagogue.
For Azouli, his town is nothing of what it once was, especially now at Passover.
It's very sad. It shouldn't be this way. It's very apocalyptic.
Since October 7th, Israel's northern border with Lebanon is now an undeclared second front line. Hezbollah fires rockets and missiles weekly into Metula. Nearly a quarter of Metula's 640 homes have been damaged. And only a handful of civilians like David chose to stay behind, carrying an automatic rifle always.
This year, we are not going to celebrate Passover. It's very hard to celebrate when your family and your town is not with you.
His office is now in a bomb shelter. He says none of this is normal.
Every mayor needs to represent and take care of his citizens. A place that's alive, that has places to work, children in school and daycare. And here, there is nothing.
No family, no work, no nothing, no personal life. We came back to the times that we've been in the military. That's what we are doing, defending our own.
Another resident, David, in combat gear, helps guard the entrance to Metula.
I'm not going to be with my family. My family doing the Passover far away from here. I am now going to do Passover with our new family, all the guys that lives in Metula and decided to stay here and defend our homes and the village.
Many families from Metula have fled just 40 miles to the south to Tiberias, an ancient city from biblical times on the edge of the Sea of Galilee, where scripture says Jesus walked on water. Today, it's a haven for those displaced by war. The Sophia Hotel is a home away from home for such families. Like Rabbi Israel Pachter and his wife Sarah, they left Metula with their 11 children. They struggle away from home. They say they'll overcome.
Part of the winning is to keep our morality up. And this is what we're trying to do.
At the Seder dinner, Rabbi Pachter tries to keep the Passover spirit high with traditional songs. The table is set with special delicacies, and the room is peopled with a community that's shaken but resilient.
You see the people trying to be happy, to do our best, to sit together, to talk, to sing. Not to be all the time sad, because if we'll be sad, it's the winning of our way out of our enemy.
That's Sarah's granddaughter, and it's that childhood joy that she wants to protect.
I don't want my kids to be depressed. I don't want them to feel that this is the end of the world. No, we're strong.
But even this festive dinner is not without despair. There were sunglasses at each table to remind them of how so many of their countrymen, women, and children are kept in darkness, now for more than 200 days. Dozens of Israeli families still wait for their loved ones held captive by Hamas.
Every Pesach, I buy myself a new dress and new shoes, and this year I couldn't buy. I felt, how can I buy a new dress and new shoes when there's hostages? For me, it's very hard, because I think about the mothers of the hostages, what hell they go through. I feel like all the world should just get up and scream and get those hostages out. It breaks my heart.
That pain during Passover has, for 22 years, been the air breathed in Netanya, here 20 miles north of Tel Aviv. In 2002, this hotel was the target of the deadliest attack on Israel by Hamas during the Second Intifada. A suicide bomber disguised as a woman stormed into a Seder dinner, killing 30 and injuring 140.
What we get in the Park Hotel before 22 years, it's like the 9/11 in America. And what we get now in October 7, it is much more.
Rina Hamani's husband, Ami, was the hotel's duty manager and among those killed while trying to stop the bomber.
It was Ami, my husband, and me. And all the children come.
Hamani had to raise their six children, all boys, by herself. Bye. She was also the manager of the hotel and had to keep it running. Every Passover is a grim reminder of her loss. Given what she suffered at the hands of Hamas, October 7th did not surprise her.
We know exactly that Hamas want to kill us. They don't want us to be in Israel. I have no illusion that they will want peace every day, some days, because 22 years before, my husband had been killed. Think the time before, and they think now the same. They want to kill us. This is Yair and his wife and his girls.
This Passover, as she has for the past two decades, Rina relies on her family to manage her grief.
Americans have to understand that we have to finish with the Hamas. We can't live with them. They have to. The Palestinian population has to change the Hamas.
The rituals of Passover this year in Israel are in many ways the same, steeped in tradition as always, from the lighting of candles to reading the story of the Exodus from ancient Egypt. But those rituals are also forever changed. Now there is also a prayer for the hostages in Gaza and a resolve that a Passover like this will not come again. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Ali Rogan.
One of the biggest developments of this week has been the expansion of college protests and encampments. Encampments continue to pop up, including today at the University of North Carolina. Meanwhile, protesters at Columbia University say they cannot reach an agreement with the school and intend to keep theirs going indefinitely. Hundreds of students have been arrested and charges have been brought against some students as well during clashes.
Overnight, more violent clashes between pro-Palestinian protesters and police, this time at Ohio State University. Officers moved to disperse a crowd after an hours-long demonstration, citing rules banning overnight events. More than a dozen people were arrested. The latest wave of protests and encampments followed demonstrations at Columbia University last week. Similar scenes have popped up at scores of other colleges over the last several days and have led to hundreds of arrests. Video from Emory University yesterday shows officers pinning a protester to the ground and tasing him. Some demonstrators are calling on their universities to cut financial ties with Israel.
We came together to make demands on the university to divest the endowment from corporations that profit off of Israeli genocide, to disclose where our money is invested in the first place.
While others want to bring attention to the war in Gaza.
We want to be visible. The university should do something about what we're asking, about the genocide that's happening.
5 minutes. Many say today's demonstrations echo college protest movements of the past, including against the Vietnam War.
What people in this strike are trying to tell the United States people, the American people, is that the country shouldn't function while this war is going on.
That includes a historic demonstration at Columbia University itself in 1968. Students occupied campus buildings demanding the university cut ties with a think tank involved in Pentagon weapons research. It was met with a heavy police response. Other Vietnam War protests in the 1960s and 70s led to clashes with authorities and mass arrests, but over time they helped to shift public opinion leading up to the eventual U.S. withdrawal. In the 1980s, a similar movement popped up at universities nationwide, calling for divestment from South Africa to end apartheid. Today, some students say they're taking lessons from those very protests.
Our core demands are financial divestment. That's been a demand from students, staff, and faculty dating back to the anti-apartheid divestment movement here at Columbia.
As the school year comes to a close, there's no sign yet that this wave of protests will end before classes let out.
As protests of Israel's war in Gaza spread to campuses across the country, some see parallels between today's demonstrations and college protests in the past. Stephen Mintz is a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin, and Angus Johnston is a professor and historian of American student culture at the City University of New York. Welcome to you both. Professor Johnston, let's just start with what the protesters are calling for here. What is their focus? What do they want as a result of these demonstrations?
It varies campus by campus, but primarily what we're looking at is they're looking for a divestment of the university's financial relationships with Israeli companies, a disentanglement of the universities from relationships with the Israeli government or military, and transparency as to the nature of those relationships where they currently exist.
Professor Mensahdi, what do you make of the demands as Professor Johnston had laid them out? Is that something you think colleges can achieve?
I think they're very unlikely to be achieved. You know, the protests of the 1960s, it was possible to achieve some kind of accommodation. First of all, one of the demands, an end to the military draft, received widespread support throughout society, and Richard Nixon's administration would make that happen. But on campuses themselves, there were some practical goals. Black studies programs, women's studies programs, co-education at the elite private universities, an end to parietals and in loco parentis regulations. There was a lot of ground for accommodation and compromise, and I don't see that much right now.
Professor Johnston, what do you make of that? Do you agree?
Well, I think that the easiest, simplest demand that they're making is a demand for transparency in their universities' relationships with Israeli institutions. And I think that that is something that is certainly winnable on a lot of campuses. I also think that in a lot of ways, the anti-apartheid movement of the 1970s and 80s is a much better analog than the mass student movement of the late 60s in some ways. And I think it's important to remember that in the case of the anti-apartheid movement, the calls for divestment on campuses began in the mid-70s, and it was a very, very long and slow process by which students were adjusting people's views of the crisis itself.
What do you make of that, Professor Mintz? Could these protests now start what could be a long chain of changing people's minds when it comes to how they see this issue?
The context today is very different than in the 1960s or 1970s, when higher education was growing and the federal and state investments in higher education were increasing. Today, the situation of American higher education is extremely precarious. Public support has diminished. Funding is hotly debated in many of the states. There are threats in some state legislatures to tax endowments, to tax university property, to tax university income. Donations to many of the leading universities have declined. This is a very treacherous moment, especially for the most well-endowed and highly selective institutions.
Professor Johnston, do you agree with that? I mean, is there a chance here that protesters run the risk of losing support the longer these protests go on because of this scenario, as Professor Mintz has laid it out?
Well, I think it's important to note that the protests themselves so far have largely been pretty moderate in their tactics. We're not seeing, as we did in the 1960s, rioting, rocks being thrown at police, even buildings being burned down. The protests themselves have been pretty moderate. The thing that is inflaming the situation right now, in terms of their tactics, the thing that's inflaming the situation right now is bringing in the cops and using the police not only to engage in mass arrests against students, but in arresting and in some cases beating and abusing faculty as well. I think it's really important to point out that there are a number of campuses at which the university has decided to take a hands-off approach to these encampments. MIT is one, Berkeley is another. And at these, the encampments have been proceeding with very little issue and very little drama.
Professor Mintz, what about that? Because we have seen some pretty heavy-handed tactics in some cases. At your campus, at the University of Texas in Austin, dozens of people were arrested. Police in riot gear were called in to disperse the crowds. Is that necessary?
Right now, we have many brand-new presidents, unseasoned senior administrators making decisions. One suspects that administrators who were more knowledgeable about past history, had more experience dealing with students, had better rapport with their student populations, that this would be playing out extremely differently. What we need to see on the part of senior administrators is a real willingness to step out of their offices, communicate with the students, and try to achieve some kind of accommodation.
Are you saying that you don't believe that the police should have been called in some of these circumstances?
Absolutely not. And the lesson of history could not be clearer, that this only escalates the situation, it worsens the situation, and it results in a degree of alienation that's very difficult to overcome.
So given all that, Professor Mintz, I'll ask you, and then Professor Johnston, if you would follow, I'll just ask you both, where do we go from here? How do you see this unfolding in the weeks ahead? Professor Mintz?
I think the conversation needs to be made more productive. In this country, if you want political change, you build coalitions. And what I'm not seeing on campus right now is an effort to have effective protests that will bring people together. When people hear anti-American sentiments, they are radically turned off. The demonstrators, in my view, should be calling for peace, for the release of the hostages, and an American foreign policy that will really result in a two-state solution.
Professor Johnston, I'll give you the last word here.
I'm really heartened by the fact that despite what Professor Mintz has said, a lot of faculty have been turning out in support of these students. Some of them turning out in support of the students' goals, but others turning out in support of the students' right to protest without being harassed and without being abused by cops. I think we are seeing the development of a new coalition on the campus, and I'm very heartened by that. And I hope that administrators take heed of that and do their bit to de-escalate the situation as well.
That is Professor Angus Johnston from the City University of New York and Professor Stephen Mintz from the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you both for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
In our interconnected, globalized economy, goods produced in one nation end up on shelves and in stores halfway around the world. And while consumers hope there's some way to protect the workers who make the products we buy, some American companies have recently come under scrutiny for alleged links to forced labor. William Brangham speaks with the journalist behind a new investigation documenting the forced labor behind Chinese seafood that ends up on American plates.
In recent years, Americans have been eating increasing amounts of seafood. It's considered one of the healthier sources of protein. But a series of new investigations by the Outlaw Ocean Project reveals that the way a lot of that seafood ends up in our stores and on our plates comes at an extraordinary human cost, specifically workers from North Korea who are forced to work in Chinese factories. Here's an excerpt of Outlaw Ocean's recent investigation.
2023 was a highly successful year for Donggang Jinhui Food. The seafood processing company based in Dandong, China, opened a large new plant at its compound in this Chinese city that sits along the North Korean border. The company doubled the amount of squid that it exported to the United States. In celebration of its success, Jinhui threw a huge party at its annual meeting, with dancers, fireworks, and a high-tech light show. The problem, though, is that a crucial reason for Jinhui's success was its widespread use of cheap North Korean labor. Jinhui was part of a much bigger state-run partnership between China and North Korea, where workers are selected by the North Korean government and exported across the border to work in Chinese seafood plants. This is a huge problem because it violates very clear and strict UN sanctions and US law prohibiting the use of North Korean workers in this very fashion.
Joining me now is the reporter you just heard, Outlaw Ocean's founder and director, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ian Urbina. Great to have you back on the NewsHour.
Thanks for having me.
This incredibly harrowing investigation looks at a series of these Chinese seafood plants in this city that you just mentioned, near the North Korean border, with tens of thousands of North Korean workers. Explain to us, how do those workers get from North Korea into China?
So this is a long-running program between China and North Korea. The two governments coordinate the selection of workers for different industries, then transfer them into the country, usually under two-year contracts where they stay in China, most often at lockdown plants where they're not allowed to leave. The North Koreans seek these jobs because they typically pay much better than what they could earn in North Korea. And there's a rigorous selection process in North Korea for those who get to go. They're mostly women. And the selection process by the North Korean government usually is a vetting that ensures they don't choose people that might defect.
So this is labor for Chinese factories. What is the upside for North Korea here?
So North Korea, because of the sanctions, largely is desperate for capital, you know, for money. And so this is a multi-million dollar money-making business where they send their workers abroad. And that foreign capital is a strong capital, Chinese capital, that they can use to buy weapons or oil or consumer goods.
Let's look at another excerpt about what the conditions are like in some of those factories.
Workers often have to sign 2 or 3 year contracts. After they arrive in China, managers confiscate their passports. If workers attempt to escape or complain to people outside the plants, their families at home can face reprisals from the government. The work itself is relentless. Shifts at the seafood plants run 14 to 16 hours. Workers receive up to 1 day off per month and few, if any, holidays or sick days. In seafood plants, the women sleep in bunk beds in locked dormitories, sometimes with 30 people to a room. Workers are forbidden from tuning in to local TV or radio and from leaving factory grounds unaccompanied. They describe loneliness, violence, and a crushing sense of captivity.
Your report also documents even worse conditions, violence, sexual abuse, particularly among the women that you're talking about here. Can you describe a little bit about what their lives are like?
This is a brutal type of work. Long hours and tight quarters, sort of relentless pace. And so they're captive on facilities that are run by men. And so this was one of the big revelations, was the extent of sexual violence against the women, quite especially when work stopped because of COVID. A lot of factories shut down, and so there was no work and no income, and therefore the women were pressured into prostitution.
I think a lot of American consumers would be horrified to think that the conditions under which food that they might be eating or buying in a store comes out of conditions like this. How does that end up here? Which retailers are we talking about?
Unfortunately, it's most retailers, most of the large ones. So this investigation that looked specifically at the use of North Korean labor, you know, found that some of the seafood was ending up, you know, routing through plants that are supplying Trident, which supplies McDonald's, you know, with fish sticks. But also Sysco, largest food company in the world that supplies public schools and federal prisons and U.S. congressional cafeteria, also getting seafood from these plants. But then the major grocery store chains, ShopRite, Giant, Walmart also. So, you know, the globalized world we live in and the way that seafood in particular largely routes through China means that many, if not most, brands in the U.S. are tainted by this.
So when you approach these companies and say, here's what we're documenting coming out of China and the conditions there, what do they say in response?
most stonewall us and don't answer questions. Some engage and say, we're taking it seriously, we're investigating, we'll get back to you. And still others say, we've taken this seriously, we've severed ties with this plant in particular. The overall underlying issue is the audits, the sort of inspections that they're supposed to be doing to check for these issues aren't working. This auditing market, which sends inspectors into plants, whether it's soccer balls or iPhones or seafood around the world, has big problems, big challenges. Often they're not doing unannounced visits, they're doing announced visits, so they tell the plant when they're coming. That's a flaw. But the other big flaw is that China is a distinct environment, and there are certain things not allowed in China. If you want to stay in the country, whether you're a journalism organization or an auditing firm or seafood company, there's certain no-go topics. And human rights and Uyghurs and North Koreans are topics you can't bring up on Monday and expect to still be in the country on Wednesday.
Ian Urbina, the project is called the Outlaw Ocean Project. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Legal cases involving former President Trump and some of his closest associates play out in state courts, the Supreme Court, and the Court of Public Opinion. Meanwhile, as foreign aid begins to arrive in Ukraine and the Middle East, protests boil over on campuses across the U.S. For more on a consequential week overseas and here at home, we turn to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post. Great to see you both.
Hey, Amna.
So a big week when it comes to the legal battles surrounding former President Trump. Let's start at the Supreme Court. David, justices there heard arguments about Trump's potential immunity, which his lawyers argue should be absolute. What did you take away from the arguments and the way the justices seem to be approaching this?
Well, a lot of commentary on the fact that a lot of the more conservative justices didn't seem interested in Donald Trump, the case right in front of them. They were interested in the precedent. And I do find it intellectually interesting, but it was a little weird that Trump was barely mentioned in some cases. And so normally you would say a president's not above law, of course. It's simple. President's not above law. No one's above law. But if you look at democracies in decline, then it is a pattern that people who are in office use their power to indict and criminalize and throw in jail the people who are in office before them of the opposing party. Mm. And so we are a nation in democracy in decline. And so it does make you think, well, if the Republicans would try to indict Ali Mayorkas and impeach him, well, then maybe once they've come in office, they will criminalize some of this action. Maybe there should be some protections against that. I don't know where you would draw the line between those presidential actions which are immune to indictments and convictions and those where you're not. But in a democracy in decline, you really have to think, how do we build in more guardrails so we don't start criminalizing political disagreement?
How do you look at it, Jonathan?
I mean, the first thing we can do as an American electorate is no longer elect someone who would crash through the guardrails and electing other people who would enable that person to crash through the guardrails. I mean, I agree with David. The idea that the Supreme Court could possibly hand down a ruling that would force Judge Chutkan to go through the counts and figure out what are private acts and what are official acts in order to determine whether the former president is immune is insane. Mm. I mean, this country is almost 250 years old, if my math is right. Only until the election of Donald Trump have we ever had to even contemplate this question. And so until we stop electing chief executives who lack the shame gene, maybe we will have to answer this question. But the fact that we are here it's really disturbing. And listening to the questioning back and forth really made me wonder whether the Supreme Court, do they really want to squander their public standing, such as it is, by handing down a decision that everyone will look at and go, what are you doing?
Can I hear from both of you briefly on this? So do you think we'll get a clear answer from them on this, Jonathan?
I don't think so.
No, David?
I don't think so either, no.
Okay, moving on then. We'll come back to that. There were a few other cases I want to get your takes on as well, because they're very different. They, of course, both involve former President Trump. In New York, there is the hush money trial that's continuing that's related to a payment he made to adult actress back in 2016. We heard testimony from a tabloid publisher named David Pecker this week confirming that he did bury stories that could have harmed then-candidate Trump. Meanwhile, in Arizona, two of Trump's closest advisors, his former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, and former attorney Rudy Giuliani, were among 18 people indicted in the fake electors scheme there to help overturn Trump's 2020 election loss to Joe Biden. David, did either of those developments in these cases, you think, change the landscape for Trump?
I don't think they changed the landscape for him. I was morbidly fascinated by the tabloid editor publisher's testimony, because that is not the way we do journalism.
Right.
Like paying people hush money, burying stories. It's just like a moral nether world that Trump had entered. Somehow, when I was reminded, I was once in the 80s invited to a party opening Trump Plaza. And Trump is there with all his cronies. And I look around the room, it's all the people you think are kind of corrupt. And a buddy of mine sees me across the room, comes up to me and says, "Not indicted, not invited." I remember thinking, like, we're really entering a different layer of New York than I was used to.
Yeah.
And that's what we're confronting. And we've been confronting it for a bunch of years. But
Jonathan, how did you look at these cases?
The testimony of David Pecker was fascinating. I mean, you know, I lived and worked in New York for 16 years. I worked at the New York Daily News. So the New York Post was a competitor.
You know,
and
this
so
world.
And so so I know this world. So David Pecker is not foreign to me. What he's talking about is not foreign to me. But I think for the larger public to hear what really goes on, particularly with that kind of tabloid newspaper, I think is fascinating. And also, let's not forget, we're talking about a former president who is in court over particular hush money payments, who has been found liable for fraud and for sexual assault, who couldn't be in Washington for the immunity hearing from when he was president. This guy is going to spend has been spending more time in court than on the campaign trail to run for re-election. I think what makes this week in this case so fascinating is that we're watching this guy be held accountable for at least a sliver of what he has allegedly done.
And meanwhile, in the New York case, we should mention he's now violated the gag order a total of 15 times.
And counting.
Is there any way for former President Trump to be reined in on that front?
I think an entire administration tried to do that for 4 years, and it didn't seem to work. I don't think there's a way to rein them.
It's not. No.
I need to ask you about President Biden as well, because we should mention, as you know, oftentimes when authorities don't want you to talk too much about something, it will get announced on a Friday afternoon. We did have an announcement today from the Biden administration. They are delaying their decision, or their plans, rather, to ban menthol cigarettes. We know that's known for its appeal to black smokers in particular. Some 81% of black adult smokers smoke menthol cigarettes. David, this has been an effort the FDA has been pushing for 10 years now. It's been through three administrations. They've failed to get it across the finish line, but why do you think the Biden administration decided to do this now?
Well, I haven't spoken to them about it, but I hope it was out of a sense of some sense that adults can make up their own mind. I frankly had the reaction the way when Mike Bloomberg in New York tried to ban the big gulp sodas. Mm. It's like too much nanny state. Now, I've seen the studies on the menthol cigarettes. The FDA does say a lot fewer people will smoke if we ban them. But at some point, we're a democracy where adults get to be treated like adults. And everyone knows this stuff is really bad for you, and people make their own decisions.
Jonathan, as you know, he's faced accusations, of course, that this is about politics, that this could alienate black voters, that President Biden needs. What do you make of that?
Well, I'm going to jump off of what David was talking about. Mm-hmm. But, you know, cigarettes are addictive, and menthol is particularly addictive. And when you're talking about an addictive substance in an addictive product that has a disproportionate impact on African Americans, well, sorry, as an African American, I look at the FDA and I say, you know what? Good for you. You should be doing this. Folks should be forced to quit, meaning this is not good for you. Mm. This is about attempting to save your life. And I think I maybe agree with you on Mike Bloomberg and the big gulp sodas, but the first thing Mike Bloomberg did when he was mayor of New York City that people started screaming about the nanny state was banning cigarettes in bars and restaurants, and now everyone loves him for it. And so I think, sure, if the Biden administration is trying to play politics by
you know, dumping this announcement on a Friday afternoon, fine, elections are decided on the margins. But in the end, what the FDA is proposing needs to be done. It's about saving lives.
Meanwhile, as you saw earlier in the show, we continue to report on the spread of these campus protests, pro-Palestinian protests by and large, and protesting Israel's war conduct in Gaza. David, they have spread very quickly. They are sustaining on campuses. How do you look at these? I mean, should these be a sort of warning sign to the Biden administration? What do you make of how quickly and widely they've spread?
I've been frustrated that people aren't making some distinctions here. So I think most of the protesters are appalled by the horrors the Palestinians are suffering, and they're well motivated by compassion. There are some people who are probably hard left people, and they get to have their views. There are a lot of people who are anti-Semitic and violent. And so you should not be able to say, as one of the Columbia students said, Zionists don't deserve to live. If that happens, you should be expelled. And so in my view, they should let them protest. But if somebody says something, go back to Poland, or even a pro-Palestinian or pro-Israeli, go back to Gaza, that's ruining the community of the campus. And so those people should be expelled. So that's the distinction that should be made. And somehow the people who are really threatening the community by threatening violence, they're not being expelled. And I think that would have a deterrent effect that would separate really the bad actors from the people who are just well motivated to try to save lives. As for the Biden administration, I do worry that Chicago convention is going to look a lot like 1968.
Really?
And that will just be terrible for the Biden administration. The president will look hapless and powerless. One other final thing that I just found interesting. Harvard does a survey. What are young adults interested in? What issues? Israel-Gaza is 15 out of 16. And so a lot of people I know are passionately on both sides of this issue.
Yeah.
But most young voters are interested in inflation, crime, healthcare, the normal issues. Mm-hmm. And so it's important for us, especially those of us who are in educated circles, not to generalize from our own immediate experience, because a lot of people are thinking about very different things mm-hmm. than this.
Jonathan?
I agree with you, David. I think the discussion about what's happening in these protests is missing a lot of nuance. Not everyone who's protesting is anti-Semitic, is rooting for violence, or is even causing the violence. They are there for legitimate reasons. And I agree with David. If a person of the college community is disrupting and saying racist, anti-Semitic things, then yes, they should be expelled. But we also should be mindful that who are these people who are saying these things? Some might be members of the university or college community, but some could be from the outside. Mm. And my big fear from the BLM movement is, you know, folks from the outside causing violence and then the blame being foisted upon the people who are legitimately protesting. And that is my big concern when we talk about this latest national protest.
Well, here's to nuance. Here's to facts. Thank you to both of you for bringing those to the table. Always Jonathan Capehart, David Brooks. Always good to see you.
Thanks, Hannah.
Few musical acts have enjoyed the success and the long run of the legendary band Bon Jovi. And a revealing new documentary series premiering tonight on Hulu tracks the highs and the lows of the Grammy Award-winning band's four decades together. Recently, Jeff Bennett spoke with frontman John Bon Jovi about Thank You, Good Night, the Bon Jovi story. It's for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
John Bon Jovi, welcome to the NewsHour.
Thank you, Jeff. Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. This docuseries is a real honest look at the band's triumphs, its setbacks. What has this experience been like, reliving your past and then considering what it all means for your future?
It was emotional when we saw Rough Cut because a lot of life was lived in these last 40 years.
Why share so much and why share it now?
Well, 40 is a milestone. You know, even if it's only the first 40 years is a long time to have been making music as we have. So I wanted to mark this milestone. We were archiving everything that I didn't realize what a hoarder I have become. So it made it easy for the storytelling. And then about this vocal surgery was not a part of the plan. But this is a couple years in the making, this film. So that just happened. And I'm not afraid to show emotion. It's just that we typically hadn't had the platform for it.
To have led one of the world's most successful bands, to have a 40-year run doing that doesn't happen by accident. What has it required of you?
I love what I do, but it's hard work. It's like anything else. You know, it's your craft, but it's also your passion. And by being true to who and what you are, which was important early on to remain true to that. You evolve as a man and as a writer, and people come along for that ride.
And you found success early, in your early 20s. How were you able to grapple with megawatt fame so early in life?
I can't tell you that I could write the book on it, but in truth, probably our upbringing, where we were from, the time in which we were born, family, the band could close the door and say, "Do you believe what just happened?" So a lot of that, you know, was living the life.
You talk in the docuseries about one of your biggest musical influences, Bruce Springsteen. I didn't realize until watching this that you actually played with his band when you were in high school.
He jumped up on stage with my band when I was
Well, that's even better. He played with your band when you were in high school. How has your relationship evolved since then?
Well, obviously, it's something that I treasure. He's so many millions of people's hero. But growing up 25 miles away from that Jersey Shore scene where he made it famous, and then Southside Johnny followed up in those footsteps, those were guys that not only I could look up to who were 12 and 13 years older, but they made the impossible seem very possible because they were, in essence, right outside your window. And now our relationships, of course, are bonded for, you know, ever, because we've become very close.
Well, as I mentioned, this docuseries focuses on the band's setbacks, and you mentioned your vocal cord surgery. It was April of 2022.
Right.
You were performing in Nashville. You came off stage and realized you might not ever be able to perform live again.
Well, it's not that I couldn't. It was more of a decision that maybe I wouldn't. I tried everything I could. There was something happening, but a picture couldn't show it to you. Hmm. When a singer has something like a nodule, it's in essence a pimple on a vocal cord. You can see it visually. I wasn't having that. What I was realizing that one of my vocal cords was atrophying. And after a lot of holistic and praying and anything I could do, including going out on the road to try to beat it into shape, mm-hmm. I'd come to the conclusion that I needed to find the right surgeon, and I did.
And there is no Bon Jovi without you and your voice. What did that feel like to potentially have the thing that you love to do taken away from you?
The truth is, I hadn't had to think about that because I've always been in the process of getting to the recovery. The new album is proof that the surgery has worked. For me now, the bar is getting back to that 2.5 hours a night, 4 nights a week. So that's the process that I'm in now.
The docuseries also features your former guitarist, Richie Sambora, who you described as your perfect foil. What do you mean by that?
Well, everybody wants a right-hand man. If they're lucky enough, they have a friend like that, you know. And he had come to see me many years ago. He says, "I need to be your guitar player." When we clicked and hit it off, you know, he became that perfect right-hand man. And in 2013, he left the band.
How big of an adjustment was it when he officially left?
Well, there was a big black hole on that side of the stage for sure, but there was nothing that was going to hinder me from continuing to write records and go out there and sell out shows. You know, if, sorry to say it, but look at the marquee, you know.
Has he watched this docuseries?
We watched it together. You know, and it was wonderfully emotional to be together, just the two of us watching it.
What do you believe sets Bon Jovi apart from other bands?
I don't know. I mean, if I did, I'd bottle it and sell it to somebody else. But I think it was the hard work, the joy of doing it. We persevered by writing songs that people could relate to. Mm-hmm. And I've been on this 40-year journey that people may have gotten off the ride along the way, but it's been honest and open. And so you can feel yourself in those shoes in different parts of your life the way I've written about them in mine.
Yeah, well, one of those songs, Living on a Prayer, classic, one of the best rock melodies ever. But when you were writing it, you thought, "I'm not so sure about this. Maybe it's a song for a movie soundtrack." How did that song ultimately come to life?
Well, it evolved. When we'd written it on that day, it was a very simple chord structure. The melody, the lyric was finished. We knew all of that. But it came to life when the band got in the room and we developed the bass line and Tico came in playing the drums, and that's when it popped. That's when the key change happened at the end. "Tommy used to work on the docks." That's how we wrote it. "Tommy used to work on the docks. Union been on strike. He's down on his luck. It's tough." With an acoustic guitar and a stand-up piano. There was no drum machines in those days. There was nothing like that. So I was like, yeah, it's good. It's good. It's good.
Did you know then that it could be as enduring as it is?
In truth, Jeff, it wasn't the first single on the album. Mm-hmm. You Give Love a Bad Name was the first single because that sort of sounded like what was on the radio, what a hit song sounded like. When we wrote that, when we were like, I think we got one here. Prayer was so different. And it was the second single. And of course, you know, the billions of streams and all that stuff later.
Right, right.
Who knew?
Well, you've got a new album coming out in June, recorded in Nashville. What does Nashville lend to the Bon Jovi sound?
I remember when I was a kid, my mom said, find your influences. And when we were talking a little bit off camera, somebody had said to me during the course of this promo tour, what's the first music you remember hearing? And the thing that came to mind initially was Beatles and Gene Autry.
Really?
So there was always a little bit of a country thing that I was aware of as a little boy, but it wasn't what drew me to music. What draws me to the city is, I jokingly say, these are my people. It's a songwriter's community. Every guy that's pumping gas is a great songwriter, and they're still making a living doing it.
You think you might tour again?
I hope so.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so do we.
Thank you.
John Bon Jovi, the new docuseries is Thank You, Good Night, The Bon Jovi Story, streaming now on Hulu and Disney+. Great to talk with you.
And you, buddy. Thank you. It's my life, it's now or never.
Later tonight on PBS, actor John Lithgow goes back to school. In Art Happens Here with John Lithgow, the author and humorist shares his passion for arts education, trying his hand at pottery, printmaking, dancing, and singing.
Snowflakes whisper beneath my window.
That was good. Yeah.
I choose to take that as a compliment.
I have a question for you, Miss B.
Yes.
Does he need to use his falsetto for Snowflake? Because he seems more comfortable without it.
When he first did it, he didn't use it.
I think I've dropped it the last few times. Yeah. And it's fine.
So, I believe it's like for everybody here, it's confidence. That you have the confidence, because the confidence controls how you perform.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
And just, what the heck, it's my voice. So I sing in my voice.
Right.
And I don't think anybody will be throwing things at me.
No, they better not.
Art Happens Here with John Lithgow premieres tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, right here on PBS. And be sure to tune into Washington Week with The Atlantic tonight for a look at former President Trump's turbulent week in court and the pro-Palestinian protests erupting across the country. And on PBS News Weekend, how Ecuador went from a model of stability in South America to a hotbed of gang violence and turf wars. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.